Your king gave the undersea permission to attack us. It came 2 nights ago, out of nowhere. Many of our people were slain before we understood what was happening. And now we are being forbidden from retaliating.
Forbidden from retaliating? I think of what Orla said about not being at war. But how can the land not be at war if the sea has already attacked? As the High King, Cardin owes his subjects the might of his military, of Maddox's army, when they are under threat. But to deny permission of striking back was unheard of. She bares her teeth.
Lord Roybin's consort was hurt, she says. Badly.
The green-skinned, black-eyed pixie who spoke as though she were mortal, the one whom the terrifying leader of the Court of Termites deferred to, laughed with. Is she going to live? I ask, my voice gone soft.
You best hope so, mortal,
Dulcamara says,
or Lord Roybin will bend his will to the destruction of your boy king, despite the vows he made.
We'll send you knights, I say.
Let Elfheim rectify our mistake.
She spits on the floor.
You don't understand. Your High King did this for you. Those were the terms under which Queen Orla would return you. Baelkin chose the Court of Termites as the target. The Undersea attacked us. And your Cardin let her. There was no mistake.
I close my eyes and pinch the bridge of my nose. No, I say. That's not possible.
Baelkin has long had a grudge against us. Daughter of dirt.
I flinch at the insult, but I do not correct her. She may rail at me all she likes. The High Court has failed the Court of Termites because of me.
We should never have joined the High Court. We should never have pledged to your fool of a king. I have come to deliver that message, and one message more. You owe Lord Roybin a favor, and it best be granted.
I worry over what he might ask me for. An unnamed favor is a dangerous thing to give, even for a mortal who cannot be forced to honor it.
We have our own spies, Seneschal. They tell us you're a good little murderer. Here is what we want. Kill Prince Baelkin.
I can't do that, I say, too astonished to weigh my words. I'm not insulted by her praise of my skill at killing, but setting me in an impossible task is hardly flattery either. He's the ambassador of the Undersea. If I killed him, we'd be at war.
Then go to war.
With that, she sweeps from the room, leaving me sitting in Oriana's parlor when the steaming tray of tea comes in. Once she is gone, and the tea is cold, I climb the steps to my room. There, I take up Taryn's knife, and the other one hidden under my bed. I take the edge of one to the pocket of my dress, slicing through it so I can strap the knife to my thigh and draw it swiftly. There are plenty of weapons in Maddox's house, including my own Nightfell. But if I start looking for them and belting them on properly, the guards are sure to notice. I need them to believe I have gone docilely back to bed. Padding to the mirror, I look to see if the knife is concealed beneath my dress. For a moment, I don't know the person looking back at me. I am horrified at what I see. My skin has a sickly pallor, and my weight has dropped enough to make my limbs look frail and stick-like, my face gaunt. I turn away, not wanting to look any more. Then I go out onto the balcony. Normally, it would be no small thing to climb over the railing and scale the wall down to the lawn, but as I put one leg over, I realize how rubbery my legs and arms have become. I don't think I can manage the climb, so I do the next best thing. I jump. Chapter 25. I get up, grass stains on my knees, my palms stinging and dirty, My head feels unsteady, as though I am still expecting to move with the current, even though I am on land. Taking a few deep breaths, I drink in the feeling of the wind on my face and the sounds of it rustling the leaves of the trees. I am surrounded by the sense of land, of fairy, of home. I keep thinking about what Dulcamera said, that Cardin refused to retaliate for the sake of my safe return. That can't have made his subjects happy with him. I am not sure even Matic would think it was a good strategy, which is why it's difficult to imagine why he agreed to it, especially since, if I stayed stuck in the undersea, he'd be out of my control. I never thought he liked me enough to save me, and I am not sure I'll still believe it unless I hear his reasons from his lips. But for whatever reason he brought me back, I need to warn him about the ghost, about Grimson and the crown, about Bilkin's plan to make me into his murderer. I start toward the palace on foot. Sure, it will take the guards far longer to realize I have gone than it would to take the stable hands to discover a missing mount. Still, I am breathing hard soon after I start. Halfway there, I have to stop and rest on a stump. You're fine, I tell myself. Get up. It takes me a long time to make it to the palace. As I walk toward the doors, I square my shoulders and try not to show just how exhausted I am.
Seneschal, one of the guards at the gate says. Your pardon, but you are barred from the palace.
You're never to deny me an audience or give an order to keep me from your side. For a delirious moment, I wonder if I've been in the undersea for longer than Terran told me. Maybe a year and a day is up, but that's impossible. I narrow my gaze. By whose command?
Apologies, my lady, another knight says.
His name is Diarmad. I recognize him as a knight Matic has his eye on. Someone he would trust.
The general, your father, gave the order.
I have to see the High King, I say, trying for a tone of command. But instead a note of panic creeps into my voice.
The Grand General told us to call you a carriage if you came and, if necessary, ride in it with you. Do you expect you will require our presence?
I stand there, furious and outmaneuvered. No, I say. Cardin couldn't refuse me an audience, but he could allow someone else to give the order. So long as Matic didn't ask for Cardin's permission, it didn't contradict my commands. And it wouldn't be so hard to figure out the sort of things I might have commanded Cardin. After all, most of it was stuff Matic would probably have ordered himself. I knew that Matic wanted to rule Fairy from behind the throne. It didn't occur to me that he might find his way to Cardin's side and cut me out. They played me, either together or separately. They played me. My stomach churns with anxiety. The feeling of being fooled, the shame of it, haunts me. It tangles up my thoughts. I recall Cardin sitting atop the dappled gray horse on the beach, his impassive face, furred cloak, and crown highlighting his resemblance to Eldred. I may have tricked him into his role, but I didn't trick the land into receiving him. He has real power. And the longer he's on the throne, the greater his power will become. He's become the High King, and he's done it without me. This is everything I feared when I came up with this stupid plan in the first place. Perhaps Cardin didn't want this power at first, but now that he has it, it belongs to him. But the worst part is that it makes sense that Cardin is out of my reach, for him to be inaccessible to me. Diarmad and the other knights stopping me at the palace doors is the fulfillment of a fear I've had since the crown was placed on Cardin's head. And as terrible as it feels, it also seems more reasonable than what I've been trying to convince myself of for months. That I am the seneschal of the High King of Faerie. That I have real power. That I can keep this game going. The only thing I wonder is why not let me languish beneath the sea? Turning away from the palace, I head through the trees to where there's an entrance into the Court of Shadows. I just hope I won't run into the ghost. If I do, I'm not sure what will happen. But if I can get to the roach and the bomb, then maybe I can rest a while and get the information I need and send someone to slit Grimson's throat before he has completed making the new crown. When I get there, though, I realize the entrance is collapsed. No, as I look at it more carefully, that's not exactly right. There's evidence of an explosion. Whatever destroyed this entrance did more damage than that. I cannot breathe. Kneeling in the pine needles, I try to understand what I am looking at, because it seems as though the Court of Shadows has been buried. This must have been the ghost's work. Betrayal on top of betrayal. I just hope the roach and the bomb are alive. Please let them be alive. And yet, without a way to find them, I am more trapped than ever. Numbly, I wander back toward the gardens. A group of fairy children has gathered around a lecturer. A lark boy picks blue roses from the royal bushes,
while Valmorin wanders beside him,
smoking a long pipe, his scald crow perched on one shoulder. His hair is unbrushed around his head, matted in places, and braided with bright cloth and bells in others. Laugh lines crease the corners of his mouth. "Can you get me inside the palace?" I ask him. It's a long shot, but I don't care about embarrassment anymore. If I can get inside, I can discover what happened to the Court of Shadows. I can get to Cardin. Valmorin's eyebrows rise.
"Do you know what they are?"
he asks me, waving a vague hand toward the boy, who turns to give us both a sharp-eyed look. Maybe Valmorin cannot help me. Maybe Faerie is a place where a madman can play the fool and seem like a prophet, but maybe he is only a madman. The lark boy continues picking his bouquet, humming a tune. "Fairies?" I ask.
"Yes, yes."
He sounds impatient.
"The folk of the air. Insubstantial. Unable to hold one shape. Like the seeds of flowers launched into the sky."
The scald crow caws. Valmorin takes a long pull on his pipe.
"When I met Eldred, he rode up on a milk-white steed, and all the imaginings of my life were as dust and ashes."
"Did you love him?" I ask.
"Of course I did,"
he tells me, but he sounds as though he's talking about long ago, an old tale that he only needs to tell the way it was told before.
"Once I met him, all the duty I felt for my family was rendered as frayed and worn as an old coat, and the moment his hands were on my skin, I would have burned my father's mill to the ground to have him touch me again."
"Is that love?" I ask.
"If not love," he says, "something very like it."
I think of Eldred as I knew him, aged and bent. But I also recall the way he seemed younger when the crown was taken from his head. I wonder how much younger he would have grown had he not been cut down. "Please," I say, "just help me get into the palace."
"When Eldred rode up on his milk-white steed,"
he says again,
"he made me an offer. Come with me," he said, "to the land under the hill, and I will feed you on apples and honey wine. And love, you will never grow old. And all you wish to know, you may discover."
"That sounds pretty good," I admit.
"Never make a bargain with them,"
he tells me, taking my hand abruptly.
"Not a wise one or a poor one. Not a silly one or a strange one. But especially not one that sounds pretty good."
I sigh. I've lived here nearly all my life. I know that. My voice startles his crow, which leaps from his shoulder to fly up into the sky.
"Then know this," Valmorin says, looking at me. "I may not help you, It is one of the things I gave up. I promised Eldred that once I became his, I would renounce all of humanity. I would never choose a mortal over a fairy.
But Eldred is dead, I insist.
And yet, my promise remains.
He holds his hands in front of him in acknowledgement of his helplessness.
We're human, I say. We can lie. We can break our word. But the look he turns on me is pitying, as though I am the one who is mistaken. Watching him walk off, I make a decision. Only one person has a reason to help me. Only one person I can be sure of.
You will come to Hollow Hall when you can, Belkin told me. Now is as good a time as any.
I force myself to walk, though the path through the Milkwood is not a direct one, and it passes too close to the sea for my comfort. When I look out at the water, a shudder comes over me. It will not be easy to live on an island if I am tormented by waves. I pass by the Lake of Masks. When I look down, I see three pixies staring back at me with apparent concern. I plunge my hands in and scrub my face with the fresh water. I even drink a little, though it's magical water and I'm not sure it's safe. Still, fresh water was too dear for me to pass up an opportunity to have it. Once Hollow Hall is in sight, I pause for a moment, to get breath and courage both. I walk up to the door as boldly as I can. The knocker on the door is a piercing through the nose of a sinister carved face. I lift my hand to touch the ring, and the carving's eyes open.
I remember you, says the door. My prince's lady.
You're mistaken, I say.
Seldom.
The door swings open with a slight creak that indicates disuse.
Hail and welcome.
Hollow Hall is empty of servants and guards. No doubt it is difficult for Prince Baelkin to cousin any of the folk to serve him when he is so clearly a creature of the undersea. And with the new rules card in passed, Baelkin's ability to trick mortals into endless servitude has also been curtailed. I walk through echoing rooms to a parlor, where Baelkin is drinking wine, surrounded by a dozen thick pillar candles. Above his head, red moths dance. He left them behind in the undersea, but now that he's back, they circle around him like a candle flame.
Did anyone see you?
He asks. I don't believe so, I say with a curtsy. He stands, going to a long trestle table and lifting a small blown glass vial.
I don't suppose you managed to murder my brother?
Madoc has ordered me away from the palace, I say. I think he fears my influence over the High King. But I can do nothing to Cardan if I am not allowed to see him. Baelkin takes another sip of his wine and walks to me.
There's to be a ball. A masquerade to honor one of the lower court lords. It will be tomorrow. And so long as you are able to steal away from Madoc, I will find a way to get you in. Can you acquire a costume and mask yourself? Or will you need that from me as well?
I can costume myself, I say.
Good.
He holds up the vial.
Stabbing would be very dramatic at such a public function. Poison is ever so much easier. I want you to carry this with you until you have a moment alone with him. And then you must add it to his wine in secret.
I will, I vow. Then he takes my chin, glamour in his voice.
Tell me that you're mine, Jude.
When he places the vial in my hand, my fingers close over it. I am your creature, Prince Baelkin, I say, looking into his eyes and lying with my whole broken heart. Do with me what you will. I am yours. Chapter 26. As I am about to leave Hollow Hall, I am suddenly beset by a wave of exhaustion. I sit down on the steps, lightheaded, and wait until the feeling passes. A plan is growing in my mind,
a plan that requires the cover of dark, and my being well-rested, and reasonably well-equipped. I could go to Terran's house, but Locke would be there, and he did try to kill me that one time. I could return to Maddox, but if I do, it's likely that the servants have been instructed to roll me up in fuzzy blankets and hold me in cushioned captivity until Cardin is no longer under my command, but sworn to obey his Grand General. Horrifyingly, I wonder if the best thing to do is to stay here. There are no servants, no one to bother me but Baelkin, and he is preoccupied. I doubt he would even notice my presence in this enormous and echoing house. I mean to be practical, but it's hard to fight against the instinct to run as far and as fast from Baelkin as I can. But I've exhausted myself already. Having snuck through Hollow Hall enough times before, I know the way to the kitchens. I drink more water from the pump just beyond it, finding myself desperately thirsty. Then I wend my way up the steps to where Cardin once slept. The walls are as bare as I remember. The half-tester bed dominates the room with its carvings of dancing, bare-breasted catgirls. He had books and papers, now gone, but the closet is still full of extravagant and abandoned clothes. I suppose they are no longer ridiculous enough for the High King, but more than a few are black as night, and there's hose that will be easy to move in. I crawl into Cardin's bed, and although I fear I will toss and turn with nerves, I surprise myself by slipping immediately into a deep and dreamless sleep. Upon waking in the moonlight, I go to his closet and dress myself in the simplest of his clothes, a velvet doublet whose collar and cuffs I rip pearls from, along with a pair of plain soft leggings. I set out again, feeling less wobbly. When I pass through the kitchens, I find little in the way of food, but there's a corner of hard bread that I gnaw on as I walk through the dark. The Palace of Elfheim is a massive mound with most of the important chambers, including the enormous throne room, underground. At the peak is a tree, its roots worming down more deeply than could come from anything but magic. Just beneath the tree, however, are the few rooms that have panes of thin crystal letting in light. They are unfashionable rooms, like the one Cardin once set fire to the floor of, and where Nikasia popped out of his wardrobe to shoot him. That room is now sealed, the double doors locked and barred so that the passage to the royal chambers cannot be accessed. It would be impossible to get inside from within the palace. But I am going to climb the hill. Quietly, stealthily, I set off, sinking my two knives into the dirt, pulling myself up, wedging my feet on rocks and roots, and then doing it again. Higher and higher I go. I see bats circling overhead and freeze, willing them not to be anyone's eyes. An owl calls from a nearby tree, and I realize how many things could be observing me. All I can do is go faster. I am nearly to the first set of windows when weakness hits me. I grit my teeth and try to ignore the shaking of my hands, the unsteadiness of my step. I am breathing too fast, and all I want to do is give myself a rest. I am sure, though, that if I do, my muscles will stiffen up, and I won't be able to start again. I keep going, although my whole body hurts. Then I stab one of the knives into the dirt and try to lever myself up, but my arm is too weak. I can't do it. I stare down the steep, rocky hill, at the twinkling lights around the entrance to the Buddha. But for a moment, my vision blurs, and I wonder what would happen if I just let go. Which is a stupid thought. What would happen is that I would roll down the hill, hit my head, and hurt myself really badly. I hold on, scrabbling my way toward the glass panes. I have looked at the maps of the palace enough times that I only have to peer into three panes before I find the correct one. It looks down on only darkness, but I get to work, chipping at the crystal with my knife
until it cracks. I wrap my hands in the sleeve of my doublet and break off pieces of it. Then I drop through it into the darkness of the rooms that Cardin abandoned. The walls and furnishings still stink of smoke and sour wine. I make my way by touch to the wardrobe. From there, it is easy to open the passage and pad down the hall, down the spiraling path to the royal chamber. I slip into Cardin's room. Though it is not yet dawn, I am lucky. The room is empty of revelry. No courtiers doze on the cushions or in his bed. I walk to where he sleeps and press my hand over his mouth. He wakes, fighting against my grip. I press down hard enough that I can feel his teeth against my skin. He grabs for my throat, and for a moment, I am scared that I am not strong enough, that my training isn't good enough. Then his body relaxes utterly, as though realizing who I am. He shouldn't relax like that. He sent me to kill you, I whisper against his ear. A shiver goes through his body, and his hand goes to my waist. But instead of pushing me away, he pulls me into bed with him, rolling my body across him onto the heavily embroidered coverlets. My hand slips from his mouth, and I am unnerved to find myself here, in the new High King's new bed, when I am still too human to lie in, beside someone who terrifies me the more I feel for him. Baelkin and Orla are planning your murder, I say, flustered.
Yes,
he says lazily.
So why did I wake up at all?
I am awkwardly conscious of his physicality, of the moment when he was half awake and pulled me against him. Because I am difficult to charm, I say. That makes him give a soft laugh. He reaches out and touches my hair, traces the hollow of my cheekbone.
I could have told my brother that,
he says, with a softness in his voice I am utterly unprepared for. If you hadn't allowed Matic to bar me from seeing you, I might have told you all this sooner. I have information that cannot wait. Cardin shakes his head.
I know not of what you speak. Matic told me that you were resting, and that we should let you heal.
I frown. I see. And in the interim, Matic would no doubt take my place as your advisor, I tell Cardin. He gave your guards orders to keep me out of the palace.
I will give them different orders,
Cardin says. He sits up in the bed. He's bare to the waist, his skin silvery in the soft glow of the magical lights. He continues looking at me in this strange way, as though he's never seen me before, or as though he thought he might never see me again. Cardin, I say, his name tasting strange on my tongue. A representative from the Court of Termites came to see me. She told me something.
What they asked in exchange for you,
he says.
I know all the things you will say. That it was foolish to agree to pay their price. That it destabilizes my rule. That it was a test of my vulnerabilities. And that I failed it. Even Matic believed it was a betrayal of my obligations. Although his alternatives weren't exactly diplomatic either. But you do not know Baelkin and Nikasia as I do. Better they think you are important to me than to believe what they do to you is without consequences.
I consider how they treated me when they believed me to be valuable, and shudder.
I have thought and thought since you were gone, and there is something I wish to say.
Cardin's face is serious, almost grave, in a way that he seldom allows himself to be.
When my father sent me away, at first I tried to prove that I was nothing like he thought me, but when that didn't work, I tried to be exactly what he believed I was instead. If he thought I was bad, I would be worse. If he thought I was cruel, I would be horrifying. I would live down to his every expectation. If I couldn't have his favor, then I would have his wrath. Baelkin did not know what to do with me. He made me attend his debauches, made me serve wine and food to show off his tame little prince. When I grew older, and more ill-tempered. He grew to like having someone to discipline. His disappointments were my lashings, his insecurities, my flaws. And yet, he was the first person who saw something in me he liked. Himself. He encouraged all my cruelty, inflamed all my rage, and I got worse. I wasn't kind, Jude. Not to many people. Not to you. I wasn't sure if I wanted you, or if I wanted you gone from my sight, so that I would stop feeling as I did, which made me even more unkind. But when you were gone, truly gone, beneath the waves, I hated myself as I never have before.
I am so surprised by his words that I keep trying to find the trick in them. He can't truly mean what he's saying.
Perhaps I am foolish, but I am not a fool. You like something about me,
he says, mischief lighting his face, making its planes more familiar.
The challenge? My pretty eyes. No matter, because there is more you do not like, and I know it. I can't trust you. Still, when you were gone, I had to make a great many decisions, and so much of what I did right was imagining you beside me, Jude, giving me a bunch of ridiculous orders that I nonetheless obeyed.
I am robbed of speech. He laughs, his warm hand going to my shoulder.
Either I've surprised you, or you are as ill as Maddox claimed.
But before I can say anything, before I can even figure out what I might say, a crossbow is suddenly lowered at me. Behind it stands the roach, with the bomb at his heels, twin daggers in her hands.
Your Majesty, we tracked her. She came from your brother's house, and she's here to kill you. Please step out of the bed, says the bomb.
That's ridiculous, I say.
If that's true, show me what charms you're wearing,
says the roach.
Rowan, is there even salt in your pockets? Because the Jude I know wouldn't go around with nothing.
My pockets are empty, of course, since Balekin would check for anything, and I don't need it anyway. But it doesn't leave me a lot of options in terms of proof. I could tell them about the Gesh from Dane, but they have no reason to believe me.
Please get out of the bed, Your Majesty, repeats the bomb.
I should be the one to get out. It's not my bed, I say, moving toward the footboard.
Stay where you are, Jude,
says the roach. Cardin slips out of the sheets. He's naked, which is briefly shocking, but he goes and pulls on a heavily embroidered dressing gown with no apparent shame. His lightly furred tail twitches back and forth in annoyance.
She woke me, he says. If she was intent on murder, that's hardly the way to go about it.
Empty your pockets,
the roach tells me.
Let's see your weapons. Put everything on the bed.
Cardin settles himself in a chair, his dressing gown enfolding him like a robe of state. I have little. The heel of bread. Gnawed, but unfinished. Two knives, crusted with dirt and grass. And the stoppered vial. The bomb lifts it up and looks at me, shaking her head.
Here we go. Where did you get this?
From Balekin, I say, exasperated. Who tried to glamour me to murder Cardin because he needs him dead to persuade Grimson to make him his own crown of Elfheim. And that is what I came to tell the High King. I would have told you first, but I couldn't get to the Court of Shadows. The bomb and the roach share a disbelieving look. If I was really glamoured, would I have told you any of that?
Probably not, says the bomb. But it would make for quite a clever piece of misdirection.
I can't be glamoured, I admit. It's part of a bargain I made with Prince Dane, in exchange for my service as a spy. The roach's eyebrows go up. Cardin gives me a sharp look, as though sure that anything to do with Dane can't be good. Or perhaps he's just surprised that I have yet another secret.
I wondered what he gave you to make you throw in your lot with us ne'er-do-wells, the bomb says.
Mostly a purpose, I say, but also the ability to resist glamour.
You could still be lying,
says the roach. He turns to Cardin.
Try her.
Your pardon? Cardin says, drawing himself up. And the roach seems to suddenly remember to whom he's speaking in such an offhanded way.
Don't be such a prickly rose, Your Majesty,
the roach says with a shrug and a grin.
I'm not giving you an order. I'm suggesting that if you try to glamour Jude, we could find out the truth.
Cardin sighs and walks toward me. I know this is necessary. I know that he doesn't intend to hurt me. I know he can't glamour me. And yet, I draw back automatically.
Jude,
he asks. Go ahead, I say. I hear the glamour enter his voice. Heady and seductive, and more powerful than I expected.
Crawl to me,
he says with a grin. Embarrassment pinks my cheeks. I stay where I am, looking at all their faces. Satisfied? The bomb nods.
You're not charmed.
Now tell me why I ought to trust you, I say to her and the roach. The ghost came, with Vulsiber, to take me to the Tower of Forgetting. Urged me to go alone. Led me right to where I was to be captured. And I still don't know why. Were either of you in on it with him?
We didn't know the ghost had betrayed us until it was too late,
the roach says. I nod. I saw the old forest entrance to the Court of Shadows.
The ghost activated some of our own explosives.
He dips his head toward the bomb.
Collapsed part of the castle, along with the lair of the Court of Shadows. Not to mention the old catacombs where Mab's bones lie,
Cardin says.
He's been planning this for a while. I was able to keep it from being worse, the bomb says. A few of us got out unscathed. Snapdragon as well, and spotted you climbing the hill of the palace. But many were hurt in the blast. The Slua, Niniel, got badly burned.
What about the ghost, I ask.
He's in the wind, the bomb says. Gone. We know not where.
I remind myself that so long as the bomb and the roach are okay, things could have been a lot worse.
Now that we're all on the same dreary page,
Cardin says,
we must discuss what to do next.
If Baelkin thinks he can get me into the masquerade, then let him bend his will toward that aim. I'll play along. I stop and turn to Cardin. Or I could just kill him. The roach claps his hand on the back of my neck with a laugh.
You did good, kid. You know that? You came out of the sea even tougher than you went in.
I have to look down because I am surprised by how much I wanted to hear someone say that. When I glance back up, Cardin is watching me carefully. He looks stricken. I shake my head to keep him from saying whatever he's thinking.
Baelkin is the ambassador of the Undersea,
he says instead, an echo of my own words to Dulcamera. I am grateful for a return to the subject.
He's protected by Orla, and she has Grimson and a mighty desire to test me. If her ambassador was killed, she would be very angry.
Orla attacked the land already, I remind him. The only reason she hasn't declared outright war is that she's seeking every advantage. But she will. So let the first blow be ours. Cardin shakes his head. He wants to have you killed, I insist. Grimson has made that a condition of Baelkin getting the crown.
You should have the hands of the smith, the bomb says. Cut them off at the wrist so he can make no more trouble.
The roach nods.
I will find him tonight. The three of you have one solution to every problem. Murder. No key fits every lock.
Cardin gives us all a stern look, holding up a long-fingered hand with my stolen ruby ring still on one finger.
Someone tries to betray the High King? Murder. Someone gives you a harsh look? Murder. Someone disrespects you? Murder. Someone ruins your laundry? Murder. I find the more I listen,
the more I am reminded that I have been awakened after very little sleep. I am going to send for some tea for myself and some food for Jude, who looks a bit pale.
Cardan stands and sends a servant for oatcakes, cheese, and two enormous pots of tea. But he does not allow anyone else into the room. He carries a large carved wood and silver tray from the door himself, setting it down on a low table. I am too hungry to resist making a sandwich from the cakes and the cheese. After I eat a second one and wash it down with 3 cups of tea, I do feel steadier.
The masquerade tomorrow,
Cardan says.
It is to honor Lord Roybin of the Court of Termites. He has come all this way to yell at me, so we ought to let him. If Balekin's assassination attempt keeps him busy until after that, so much the better. Roach, if you can spirit away Grimson to somewhere he won't cause any trouble, that would be most helpful. It's time for him to choose sides and bend his knee to one of the players in this little game. But I do not want Balekin dead.
The Roach takes a sip of tea and raises one bushy brow. The bomb sighs audibly. Cardan turns to me.
Since you were taken, I've gone over all the history I could find on the relationship of the land and the sea. From when the first High Queen, Mab, summoned the Isles of Elfheim from the depths, our folk have occasionally skirmished. But it seems clear that should we fight in earnest, there will be no victor. You said that you thought Queen Orla was waiting for an advantage to declare war. Instead, I think she is trying a new ruler. One she hopes she can trick or replace with another indebted to her. She thinks me young and feckless, and means to take my measure.
So what? I ask. Our choice is to endure her games, no matter how deadly, or engage in a war we cannot win? Cardan shakes his head and drinks another cup of tea.
We show her that I am no feckless High King.
And how do we do that? I ask.
With great difficulty,
he says,
since I fear she is right.
Chapter 27. It would be a small thing to smuggle one of my own dresses out of my rooms, but I don't want Balekin to guess I've been inside the palace. Instead, I head to the Mandrake Market on the tip of Innsmore to find something suitable for the masquerade. I've been to the Mandrake Market twice before, both times long past and accompanying Matic. It is exactly the sort of place that Orianna warned Taryn and me away from. Entirely too full of folk eager to make bargains. It's open only in the misty mornings, when most of Elfheim is asleep. But if I can't get a gown and a mask there, I will have to steal one out of a courtier's wardrobe. I walk through the stalls, a little queasy from the smell of oysters smoking on a bed of kelp, the scent reminding me forcefully of the undersea. I pass trays of spun sugar animals, little acorn cups filled with wine, enormous sculptures of horn, and a stall where a bent-backed woman takes a brush and draws charms on the soles of shoes. It takes some wandering, but I finally find a collection of sculpted leather masks. They are pinned to a wall and cunningly shaped like the faces of strange animals, or laughing goblins, or boorish mortals, painted gold and green and every other color imaginable. I find one that is of a human face, unsmiling. "This one," I say to the shopkeeper. A tall woman with a hollow back. She gives me a dazzling smile.
"Seneschal," she says, recognition lighting her eyes. "Let it be my gift to you."
"That's very kind," I say, a little desperately. All gifts come with a price, and I am already struggling to pay my debts.
"But I'd prefer," she winks, "and when the High King compliments your mask, you will let me make him one."
I nod, relieved that what she wants is straightforward. The woman takes the mask from me, laying it down on the table and pulling out a pot of paint from beneath a desk.
"Let me make a little alteration."
"What do you mean?" She takes out a brush.
"So she looks more like you."
And with a few swipes of the brush, The mask does bear my likeness. I stare at it and see Taryn. I will remember your kindness, I say, as she packs it up. Then I depart and look for the fluttering cloth that marks a dress shop. I find a lace maker instead, and get a little turned around in a maze of potion makers and tellers of fortunes. As I attempt to find my way back, I pass a stall occupied by a small fire. A hag sits on a little stool before it. She stirs the pot, and from it comes the scent of stewing vegetables. When she glances in my direction, I recognize her as Mother Merrow.
"Come and sit by my fire," she says.
I hesitate. It doesn't do to be rude in Faerie, where the highest laws are those of courtesy. But I am in a hurry. I am afraid that I
have some soup, she says,
picking up a bowl and shoving it toward me.
It is only that which is most wholesome.
Then why offer it to me? I ask. She gives a delighted laugh.
If you had not cost my daughter her dreams, I might well like you. Sit. Eat. Tell me, what have you come to the Mandrake Market for?
A dress, I say, moving to perch by the fire. I take the bowl, which is filled with an unappetizing thin brown liquid. Perhaps you could consider that your daughter might not have liked a princess of the sea for a rival. I spared her that, at least. She gives me an evaluating look.
She was spared you, moreover.
Some might say that was a prize above price, I tell her. Mother Merrow gestures to the soup. And I, who can afford no more enemies, bring it to my lips. It tastes of a memory I cannot quite place. Warm afternoons and splashing in pools and kicking plastic toys across the brown grass of summer lawns. Tears spring to my eyes. I want to spill it out in the dirt. I want to drink it down to the dregs.
That'll fix you right up, she says,
as I blink back everything I was feeling and glare at her.
Now, about the dress. What would you give me for one?
I take off the pair of pearl earrings from the undersea. How about these? For the dress and the soup. They are worth more than the price of 10 dresses, but I do not want to engage in any more bargaining, especially with Mother Merrow. She takes them, sliding her teeth over the nacre, then tucking them away in a pocket.
Well enough.
Out of another pocket, she takes a walnut and holds it out to me. I raise my eyebrows.
Don't you trust me, girl? She asks.
Not as far as I can throw you, I return. And she lets out another cackle. Still, something is in the walnut. And it's probably some kind of gown. Because otherwise, she wouldn't be honoring the terms of the agreement. And I will not play the naive mortal for her, demanding to know how everything works. With that thought, I stand.
I don't much like you, she says,
which is not an enormous surprise, although it stings.
But I like the sea folk far less.
Thusly dismissed, I take the walnut and my mask and make the trek back to Innsmire and Hollow Hall. I look out at the waves all around us, the expanse of ocean in every direction, with its constant, restless, white-tipped waves. When I breathe, salt spray catches me in the back of my throat. And when I walk, I must avoid tide pools with little crabs in them. It seems hopeless to fight something so vast. It seems ridiculous to believe we can win.
Baelkin is sitting in a chair near the stairs when I come into Hollow Hall.
And where did you spend the night?
He asks. All insinuation. I go over to him and lift my new mask. Costuming. He nods, bored again.
You may ready yourself,
he says, waving vaguely to the stairs. I go up. I'm not sure which room he intends for me to use, but I go again to Cardin's. There, I bathe. Then I sit on the rug before the unlit grate and crack open the walnut. Out spills pale apricot muslin, frothing quantities of it. I shake the dress. It has an empire waist and wide gathered sleeves that start just above the elbow, so that my shoulders are bare. It hangs down to the floor in more gathered pleats. When I put it on, I realize the fabric is the perfect complement to my complexion, although nothing can make me look less starved. No matter how the dress flatters me, I can't get away from the feeling that my skin doesn't fit. Still, it will do well for the night. As I adjust it, however, I realize the dress has several cunningly hidden pockets. I transfer the poison to one. I transfer the smallest of my knives to another. Then I attempt to make myself presentable. I find a comb among Cardin's things and attempt to fix my hair. I have nothing to put it up with, so I wear it loose around my shoulders. I wash out my mouth. Then, tying the mask on, I head back to where Baelkin waits. Up close, I'm likely to be recognized by those who know me well, but otherwise I think I will be able to pass unnoticed through the larger crowd. When he sees me, he has no visible reaction, but impatience. He stands.
You know what to do?
Sometimes lying is a real pleasure. I take the stoppered vial from my pocket. I was a spy for Prince Dane. I have been a part of the Court of Shadows. You can trust me to kill your brother. That brings a smile to his face.
Cardin was an ungrateful child to imprison me. He ought to have put me beside him. He ought to have made me seneschal. Really, he ought to have given me the crown.
I say nothing, thinking of the boy I saw in the crystal, the boy who still hoped he might be loved. Cardin's admission of who he has become since haunts me. If he thought I was bad, I would be worse. How well I know that feeling.
I will mourn my youngest brother,
Baelkin says, seeming to cheer himself a bit at the thought.
I may not mourn the others, but I will have songs composed in his honor. He alone will be remembered.
I think of Dulcamera's exhortation to kill Prince Baelkin, that he was the one who ordered the attack on the Court of Termites. Maybe he was responsible for the ghost setting explosives in the Court of Shadows. I recall him under the sea, exultant in his power. I think of all that he's done, and all he intends to do, and am glad I am masked.
Come,
he says, and I follow him out the door. Only Locke would make the ridiculous choice of arranging a masquerade for a grave affair of state, such as hosting Lord Roybin after an attack on his lands. And yet, when I sweep into the Buddha on Baelkin's arm, such a thing appears underway. Goblins and Griggs, pixies and elves all cavort in endless intertwined circle dances. Honey wine flows freely from horns, and tables are stacked with ripe cherries, gooseberries, pomegranates, and plums. I walk from Baelkin toward the empty dais, scanning the crowd for Cardin, but he is nowhere to be seen. I catch sight of salt-white hair instead. I am partway to the convocation from the Court of Termites when I pass Locke. I swing toward him.
You tried to kill me.
He startles. Maybe he doesn't remember the way he limped on his wedding day, but surely he must have known I would see the earrings in Terran's ears. Perhaps since the consequences took so long in coming, he supposed they wouldn't come at all.
It wasn't supposed to be so serious,
he says, reaching for my hand, a ridiculous grin coming to his face.
I only wanted you to be afraid the way you'd frighten me.
I jerk my fingers from his grip. I have little time for you now, but I will make time for you anon. Terran, dressed in a gorgeous panniered ball gown all robin's egg blue, embroidered with delicate roses, and wearing a lacy mask over her eyes, sweeps up to us.
Make time for Locke? Whatever for?
He raises his brows,
then throws an arm over his wife's shoulders. Your twin is upset with me. She had a gift all planned out for you, but I was the one to present the gift in her stead.
That's accurate enough that it's hard to contradict him, especially given the suspicious way that Taryn is looking at me.
What gift?
She wants to know. I ought to just tell her about the riders, about how I hid the fight in the forest from her because I didn't want her to be upset on her wedding day, about how I lost the earrings, about how I cut one of the riders down and threw a dagger at her husband, about how, whether or not he wanted me dead, he was certainly willing to let me die. But if I say all that, will she believe me? As I am trying to decide how to respond, Lord Roybin moves in front of us, looking down at me with his shining silver eyes. Locke bows. My sister sinks into a beautiful curtsy, and I copy her as best I can.
An honor, she says. I've heard many of your ballads.
Hardly mine,
he demurs,
and largely exaggerated. Though blood does bounce on ice, that line is very true.
My sister looks momentarily discomfited. Did you bring your consort?
Kay, yes. She's in plenty of those ballads as well, isn't she? No, I am afraid she didn't come this time. Our last journey to the High Court was not quite what I promised her it would be.
Dulcamera said she was badly hurt, but he is taking care to avoid saying so. Interesting care. Not a single lie, but a web of misdirection.
The coronation, Taryn says.
Yes,
he goes on.
Not quite the mini-break either of us envisioned.
Taryn smiles a little at that, and Lord Roybin turns toward me.
You will excuse Jude?
He asks Taryn.
We have something pressing to discuss.
Of course, she says, and Roybin escorts me away, toward one of the darker corners of the hall. Is she well? I ask. Kay?
She will live,
he says tersely.
Where is your High King?
I scan the hall again, my gaze going to the dais and the empty throne. I don't know, but he'll be here. Only last night, he expressed his regret over your losses and his desire to speak with you.
We both know who was behind this attack,
Roybin says.
Prince Baelkin blames me for throwing my weight and influence behind you and your princeling when you got him a crown.
I nod, glad of his calm.
You made me a promise,
he says.
Now it is time to determine if a mortal is truly as good as her word.
I will fix things, I vow. I will find a way to fix things. Lord Roybin's face is calm, but his silver eyes are not, and I am forced to remember that he murdered his way to his own throne.
I will speak to your High King, but if he cannot give me satisfaction, then I must call in my debt.
And with that, he departs in a swirl of his long cloak. Courtiers cover the floor, executing intricate steps, a circle dance that turns in on itself, splits into three, and reforms. I see Locke and Taryn out there, together, dancing. Taryn knows all the steps. I will have to do something about Locke eventually, but not tonight. Maddox sweeps into the room, Oriana on his arm. He is dressed in black, and she in white. They look like chess pieces on opposite sides of the board. Behind them come Mikhail and Randolin. A quick scan of the room, and I spot Baithin speaking with a horned woman. It takes me a moment to recognize. When I do, it comes with a jolt. Lady Asha, Cardin's mother. I knew she was a courtier before. Saw it in the crystal globe on Eldred's desk. But now it is as though I am seeing her for the first time. She wears a high-skirted gown, so that her ankles show along with little shoes cunningly made to resemble leaves. Her whole dress is in shades of autumn, leaves and blossoms of moor cloth stitched over the length of it. The tips of her horns have been painted with copper, and she wears a copper circlet, which is not a crown, but reminiscent of one. Cardin